Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 135, where we are discussing an article by Thomas Guerin titled Boundary Work and the Demarcation of Science from Non-Science, Strains and Interests in Professional Ideologies of Scientists, published in the American Sociological Review in 1983. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Good morning. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, everyone. This is Rohan calling from London in the UK.
Hi, everyone. This is Anu calling from Calcutta in India.
Welcome, everyone. And we're returning to a discussion that we had last year about the sociology of science. And this time we have a work from Thomas Guerin from 1983, and it's titled Boundary Work and the Demarcation of Science from Non-Science Strains and Interests in Professional Ideologies of Scientists, which is a bit of a mouthful. Anu, you had suggested this reading, so why don't you go ahead and break it down for us?
Sure. Thank you so much, Tom. This reading, I got introduced to it when I was doing my dissertation. So one of my essays deals with the topic of boundary work in the area of traditional systems of medicine and modern medicine. And so that's when I started tracing the origin of the concept and I came across Guerin's work. And I thought it was extremely interesting for a couple of reasons. One, I had read Weber's Science as Vocation, again, for work on my dissertation. And so following on that and seeing this reading was a very interesting follow-up in terms of how the idea of science is constructed as a profession, as a vocation. So it was a nice follow-on. What I found most interesting about the reading was it kicks off the field of boundary work and then later on social symbolic work. So how we manage symbolic resources, material resources, political resources, more than just ideological debates and resources. And so this idea that there can be symbolic management in fields such as science as well. And on top of that, the examples that Guerin picks to show us how science was sort of inserted almost between the fields of religion, and I say field with a specific purpose, religion and the practical applications of science, so engineering and mechanics. And so how there's an insertion and a construction of space in some sense in the whole discourse on science, and the debates kind of oscillate. And so the contrast between religion and mechanics, and how science then speaks to both in very different manners, almost always adopting the language of the other, depending on who the audience is. So all of this seems to be a precursor to later streams of literature that today give a lot of importance to the idea of audiences and evaluations and how that brings legitimacy and resources to certain disciplines. So the whole field of social evaluations, social symbolic management, I think all of that sort of comes from here. And I have more thoughts on the readings as we go. But that is what I find interesting about this and the idea of interests and strains and how these are used as an interplay while we have these debates.
So I also read this at some point during my dissertation. So I remember the broad concept. And then when I opened my notes, I realized I clearly enjoyed the paper at the time because I took a bunch of notes and I had engaged with it well at the time. And it was a pleasure to revisit. But one thing I noticed on this revisit was that I also really like how the paper is framed itself in the beginning. And so this, and you see this often in sociology journals, but it's put as part of a grand conversation. And so he starts off talking about the problem of demarcation, quote unquote, which is a grand problem in, you know, kind of philosophy of science, sociology of science, and has been there for hundreds of years. And the idea of demarcating science from non-science. And then he does this thing where he says that people have argued both sides of this problem. It's quite a difficult thing. There's no easy or clear answer. But it's one thing to analytically think about the problem of demarcation, But if we look out in the real world, clearly people are demarcating between science and non-science. He gives the example of how, you know, curriculum have chemistry but not alchemy in it, and people are deciding what comes into chemistry versus alchemy and hence is left out of a university curriculum. Granting and funding agencies are deciding what projects to fund and not fund. So in practice, the demarcation is happening. And so then, so let's study what people are doing in practice, aside from the analytical problem, which then he uses as a way to set up the fact that, okay, people are actually engaging in a lot of ideological efforts that he then calls boundary work to create this. So I really liked the setup of like, you're connecting it to this grand thing, but then also in a compelling way saying, let's set the whole thing aside and just look at what people are doing.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because this is the first time that I had read this paper. It was not part of my program. So it was a very approachable paper, dense in some parts, but definitely when he gets to the examples, it gets a little bit easier if you're not already attuned to the philosophies that he's talking about. And what I appreciated about it is, you know, the demarcation between science and not science. The three episodes or three cases that he presents framed very different forms of demarcation. So the first being science versus truly not science, which would be like what could be considered scientific versus absolutely not scientific. Religion and engineering provide two venues for that. Then there is sort of like the, okay, which parts of science really aren't science? And that we should kick out. That was the second case. And then the third one is a very interesting one because it's an internal demarcation between what we're allowed to talk about and what we're not. What within science is within bounds of the public discourse versus what is to be considered private, secret, or whatever. There's a consistent thread that goes through that there's a sense of what is to be considered valid within the scientific community and what should not be. But this really helped frame different parts of that question that have broader applicability. And oh, by the way, also ties into not just other episodes that we've done on the sociology of science. It's just talking about Merton. Merton, the Kuhn episode, episode 130 that we did recently. But also professionalism. As a matter of fact, Guerin was cited in Abbott's The System of Professions, and he talks a lot about, in a parallel fashion, how different scientific or different communities demarcate their jurisdictions. You know, what is their professional knowledge that they own and where those compete. So there is a lot of connection to other things that we've discussed in the program.
I do want to pick up on what Tom said about the last application or the last discussion that Guerin has, because that did remind me of Rohin's work on secrecy. And so it's interesting and not surprising that Rohin mentions it as well. And so, yeah, that it'll be great to discuss that at some point. And I did see a connection also, and if we can bring it in later, to the idea of provincializing Europe by Anshuman Prasad. It's slightly different, so it's not truly talking about science in the way that these readings and discussions are, but also the fact that the lasting effect of what European colonization has done again to the validity of knowledge bodies that we talked about. And so that boundary work that Anshuman Prasad talks about, the need to construct a boundary around Europe and the knowledge bodies, I thought that was interesting as well, and maybe there was a connect.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful how this paper connects, like both of you said, to so many prior episodes in this podcast, and look forward to kind of getting to those. Let's start off with giving listeners a sense of the structure of the paper and what it's trying to do. Essentially, there's two things happening in parallel. In the empirical side, there's three historical, well, the third case is contemporaneous to the time of writing, but there's three cases that the author is using to look at, like Tom said, very different kinds of boundary work. And before that, there's this little theoretical bit that he does successfully circle back to, where he's trying to scaffold this idea of how, okay, this is an ideological boundary work exercise. He's scaffolding it with sociological theories of the concept of ideology itself. And he talks about two types of theories, so which, you know, makes its way to the title of the paper, but so strain theories and interest theories. My understanding of it was, you know, strain views of ideology are to do with ideology as a vehicle to kind of reconcile tensions between things. So, for example, a classic strain theory tension is the tension between means and ends. What kind of goal you can have and what's the good right way to achieve that goal. And religion is an ideology that tells you both things. It gives you a certain set of goals that are noble and certain means of reaching it as well that are noble. And so as an ideology, it reconciles strains in our lives. We have conflicts often between multiple goals, competing demands, different ways to achieve the same thing. You know, do you want to feed your family by stealing a loaf of bread or cultivating wheat or whatever it may be? So that strain gets resolved through ideology. And then the second category is interest, which is that ideology is not just a vehicle for reconciling strain, but rather almost a weapon or a social lever. These are all words that the author uses to advance certain interests, and hence the word interest. And so then that's the way the layperson tends to think of ideology anyways. In today's world, it's about advancing interests. So those are the kind of moving parts of the paper. He then digs into the three cases, and then in the end comes back to talk about how his analysis shows a synthesis of how ideology and boundary work can be used to cover both the strain view of ideology and the interest view of ideology. So in the case of science, you can do boundary work to help reconcile some tensions inherent within science. You know, how theoretical is it? How useful and practical is it? You can also do boundary work to advance interests. Okay, we want to get funding for the science faculty in the university. I'll let one of you walk us through the cases.
Before we get to the cases, I was also hoping to highlight the stress that he kind of puts on looking at the rhetoric of science, as opposed to possibly just the veracity of the discourse. So how the framing is done, again, to kind of plug into the strain and interest aspect of the discourse. But this focus on rhetoric, I thought, was very interesting, and the style and content. And he talks specifically about stylistic resources that people use in order to align with either of those. So I think, again, this was maybe one of the earlier papers that talks about rhetoric and studying rhetoric, possibly, which again today has become so much more larger and popular as a stream of literature. So I thought that was interesting. The other thing that he does while setting up the paper is, and as Rohan was saying earlier, he talks about, you know, what has been done before, and let's set that aside. And I quite thought the question that he poses is very interesting. He asks how science acquires that intellectual authority. And again, I thought this was the beginnings of asking process questions. So he says, yeah, we know this, we know that, we know all of this about science, but we don't know the how of it. And so let us examine that. And so that is the question he's asking in the paper. How is it that this authority comes to be ascribed to science? And I thought that process view was very interesting as well in the paper. The last point that I want to make was, while we're talking about the sociology of science, it's interesting that he positions the whole thing in the sociology of ideology. And so throughout the paper, the one thing that kept striking me was science as ideology and science as culture. He very clearly talks about that through one of the cases. How can we look at science as ideology and culture? And these are not words we associate with science very easily, because they take away from the rigor and the process, etc. But the fact that these can also be ways to look at science, I thought it was quite nicely done to give us those alternate views of science. And it reminds me of the reading by Roger Friedlin, where he does talk about how today science possibly has become like religion, equally dogmatic and equally sort of inflexible. Although this paper is talking about how science is supposed to be open, you know, how Tyndall is making that case, that it's supposed to be open-minded and humble. And so now if we connect all of these things over a period of time, how things have changed and how ideology has crept into science itself. So these were thoughts that I had about the way the paper was set up.
Right. And I marked up that whole section as well, because, I myself have had some concerns about how we lionize science in a way. And when I'm talking about we, I'm talking about the broad we in society that has considered science to be a noble thing, not just a good thing, but a noble thing. And the natural tensions that it has from an ideological perspective against, say, religion, where it is, you know, it has had a lot of commonality, but also a lot of conflict. And so I did appreciate that, and is mostly referring to page 783 here, that he sort of presents that there are anti-science views, views against the science as a noble ideology that are presented. He highlighted Braverman, who we also did an episode on, Habermas, and Comte. So, you know, he's putting this together to try to make sure that we're not thinking, you know, or that we're positioning ourselves in taking a critical eye toward science while also trying to talk about these demarcations in which science establishes itself as a good thing and how society has accepted it as a noble thing. And I suppose I should clarify what I mean by the difference. You know, good as in producing things that are useful or producing additional knowledge. Noble in terms of high prestige, high position, deserving of honor and praise from society.
Which is a great segue to the first case that he analyzes, because the whole point of the paper is that the way, let's say right now we're in this place where science is seen as both good and noble, and that's a nice distinction you made there, Tom. The point of the paper is that that's the result of boundary work done in the past by leading figures. And the first case that he analyzes is that of Roger Tyndall, who was a scientist in the late 1800s in Victorian England, and also a leader in the Royal Institution at the time, a precursor to the Royal Society, and clearly a public figure based on the documents he's able to gather of Roger Tyndall's speeches, correspondence, and so on that show his thoughts. And this point about science, let's say today, being seen as both good and noble comes from the boundary work that we see Roger Tyndall doing, because he's trying to demarcate science from two different fields. One is religion, the other is mechanics or engineering at the time, which itself was fascinating to me, the idea that actually a threat to science back in the day was also engineering. In fact, the author says, and I quote, "Practical inventions of Victorian craftsmen," so this is on page 785, "practical inventions of Victorian craftsmen, steam engines, telegraphs, did almost as much to stall the entry of science into universities as the Stonewall tactics of the church." So you've got these two competing professions. And again, this is before Abbott's system of professions kind of theoretical idea, but you already see that idea of jurisdictional conflict. And you've got Roger Tyndall trying to say, compete with religion, saying that science is good, it's useful, it makes us have better predictions. So Roger Tyndall proposed a controversial experiment where apparently at the time, the prime minister, you know, when there was, let's say, a pandemic or something bad going on, the prime minister of the UK would, or of Great Britain at the time, would call for a day of prayer. And Roger Tyndall said, why not do that experimentally where we all pray for one hospital and compare the mortality rates before and after for that hospital versus hospitals where prayer didn't happen, what today would be called a diff and diff design in econometrics. And he's trying to say that science is good in the sense of it's more useful, it'll do more good, it has more utility. But on the same time, when you see Roger Tyndall try to do boundary work against mechanics, he's trying to say science is noble. There's a utility in thinking higher thoughts and being more theoretical rather than just knowing that things work without knowing why they work. And so these different boundaries you're trying to create against different kind of opponents in a certain sense lead to these different qualities. And then in the case of science, because they succeeded, they get to hold both qualities over time, and they get to be seen as good and more useful than the church, but also more noble than engineering or applied work, and so on.
Yeah, I think later in the reading, towards the end, when the author talks about the fact that there are ambiguities in science and internal inconsistencies in science, I think this first case, where science is again being inserted between religion and mechanics or engineering, demonstrates that so well in the arguments that are being made. So science not as abstract as religion, the fact that, you know, it produces useful knowledge, but the exact same arguments then kind of are turned on their head when it's being compared with mechanics. And I had marked a portion which I thought was extremely interesting, where he talks about the Iliad. So in the debates with religion, he talks about religion as being poetry and art and beautiful and being seen for its own sake, but science doesn't do that. And then when he comes to mechanics, he says, you know, Homer's Iliad is valuable on its own. Like, and so science, for the sake of science, is valuable in itself. And I thought that was extremely interesting to see, again, this boundary work, right? The posturing or the signaling or the rhetoric that you adopt, depending on who you're speaking to. Demonstrating, again, the, I wouldn't call it internal inconsistency or ambiguity even within the field, but just the scope, because both things are true, as the author says towards the end. It's not like he was being disingenuous. It is just that this was the place that science kind of did occupy. And so I thought it was a great demonstration of that case of ambiguity being used very well to construct space for it, for science.
If there's one thing, and I'm gonna mention something that isn't in this paper, but is something that was going through my mind reading this first case. In a practical sense, what is an ideology? An ideology is a way of constructing a simple explanation for something, for a series of phenomena that are just inherently complex. And what are some of the first things that you do when you're either develop or you adopt some sort of an ideology? You establish certain axioms, and I'm going to use the word axiom as opposed to assumption. You know, an assumption is something that you assume to be true in order to make sense of things. And part of the idea is that you challenge an assumption. That's what we would consider to be proper critical thinking. But an axiom is not generally challengeable. That is an element of ideologies, established ideologies, that is where the source of so much conflict comes in. Because when you have a challenger come in, what are the first things that they're challenging or questioning is an axiom. And that's where the established community with this ideology, that's a non-negotiable. That makes it very, very difficult for that to respond. And I kind of saw that as a thread running through in Science as Non-Religion, the section Science as Non-Religion, 785. You can kind of see how, like, it's a direct challenge to some of the things that are axiomatically held by the clergy, just a direct challenge to it. And if your ideology is challenged at that level, it's really, you wind up being back on your heels. And we saw that in the Abbott episode that we did talking about the mental health professions, when the clergy lost jurisdiction over the personal problems domain, and it was taken over by the scientists, the psychotherapists or whatever. The established authority could not cope with this kind of a challenge. You know, that was what was going through in my mind as I read this example, because it seemed to be like a very, very stark case of how an ideology can become so cemented by its own axioms that it becomes inflexible and therefore vulnerable.
A flip side of that, which we see in the earlier days, and as we see in this paper, is that in the beginning, you're almost being flexible to the at the extreme extent, potentially hypocritical, where, like Anu said, the example of poetry, right? So in the beginning of page 786, there's a quote of Roger Tyndall demarcating science from religion, saying the book of Genesis should be read as a poem, not a scientific treatise. And then on page 787, he compares the value of science to the value of the Iliad. And so then if you reconcile these two, he's saying that science is like the book of Genesis in terms of its value. But he's saying these to different audiences. And because of that, and which I appreciated that the author kind of went to that next level of nuance, where on page 787, he, as in Thomas Guerin, says, it would be reductionistic to explain these inconsistent parts of an ideology merely as fiction conjured up to serve scientists' interests. So it's not simply arbitrary boundary work for the sake of whatever works, whatever is expedient at a given point in time. He says there's a quote-unquote genuine ambivalence that then, in his analysis, Roger Tyndall exploits for the sake of boundary work. To your point, Tom, what happens then is that early on, you're trying to do this kind of complex boundary work that, and you're exploiting or resourcing genuine ambivalence within the field of or the concept of science. And when it succeeds, now it's succeeded with almost at the kernel some degree of ambivalence, which is what then you see in our next case, even though our next case precedes chronologically his first case. But the second case is that of phrenology, which was the kind of trying to be a science, specifically trying to be the science of understanding human personality and behaviors, based on physiological features of the brain and the skull. And there you have an intra-science debate of, is this science or not? Is phrenology the same as, you know, physics or chemistry? And they are, again, leveraging that ambivalence where the person who's, so in this case, it's where the stage is early 1800s Edinburgh, and it's anatomists versus phrenologists. And it's George Combe, C-O-M-B-E, who's voicing in favor of the phrenologists. But George Combe says the point is that we are the it's a unified view, supersedes religion and other cultures, because now through explaining the brain, we can even explain the part of the brain that is responsible for religiosity. And so then how religious someone is because is a function of the size of that part of their brain. So in some sense, it is in agreement with the kinds of things that later on we see Roger Tyndall saying to promote science. But because there's so much ambivalence, the ambivalence that is a weapon when you're looking outwards can be a crutch when you're looking inwards, because you're now trying to fend off disputes within.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much, because the whole case on phrenology was fascinating to me, because it gets into the rhetoric. You know, it's where we really see the rhetoric come into play. The promise of what a new ideology or a new field. Yeah, and I've got to be careful here because I'm using ideology perhaps a little bit different. It's more like, I guess, the jurisdiction, a jurisdictional promise. Because on the one hand, you know, yes, Guerin shows how Combe was using scientific methods to derive what today we would consider to be absolutely outlandish conclusions. And at the same time was promoting phrenology as the promise of something that could answer so many questions about what we understand about the brain, about the personality, the connections between the physical or the biological specimen and the consciousness, etc. But the process of allowing the scientific communities to exercise their independent pursuit of knowledge so that the better informed, the more accurate, wins out, you know, that process was fine, but phrenology didn't just roll over and die on it under its own weight. Its adherents kept at it for quite some time afterwards. And Abbott also talked about that in his book, how, you know, when the jurisdictional settlement occurs, it's not necessarily clean. The old community could just hold on, and it only dies when people stop using the knowledge.
Yeah, it's not clean, and it seems to be also the case that it never goes away necessarily. Like phrenology itself perhaps is clearly demarcated and success, and there was a successful battle for the anatomists in early 1800s Edinburgh. But the aspects that George Combe, the phrenologist, was trying to bring into the ideology of science, and here Guerin demarcates, let me not use that word, Guerin lists out three kind of things that were distinct about Combe's ideology on page 789. But essentially the three things are, Combe looked at science as being expandable into religious questions as well. So this idea that it unifies everything and can explain everything. We see that kind of debate in evolution versus creationism, and how much can you explain religious history and the beginning of everything using methods of science as well. Combe was also battling on the subject of saying that it's not a precise science, phrenology. It's estimative and it's subjective. It has to do with the feel of the phrenologist as the phrenologist is feeling the skull. And today you might have, you know, radiologists arguing against total overtake of AI by saying that, no, it's not that clear cut. Fine, there's statistical correlations, but a really experienced one can tell when a certain spot is malignant or benign. How, again, in medicine, it's a very common theme, how precise versus subjective a science it is. And then the third domain of kind of combat was that it's capable of being evaluated by non-specialists. And that, of course, we see a lot in today's, you know, world, the idea of populism creeping into science, and can people do their own research on whether or not vaccines work and what causes autism versus not. So those domains of battle of jurisdictional conflict that George Combe was using to fight for phrenology continue to be contentious regardless of the specific field being fought for, whether it's creationism or anti-vax or what have you.
I'm glad Rowan brought mention of creationism that the paper has, and I also want to talk about scientific populism as a term that's mentioned here. But I did the debate about creationism that had sprung up at that time. I did think about it a little bit in the sense of, as you were saying, you know, the religious history, how that has progressed, and also then the history of science, how that progresses in parallel. A couple of things came to mind. One, the fact that, you know, Darwin's theory was such a pivotal moment in terms of the split between religion and science became so pronounced at that point, because it was then this war over us, you know, where did we come from? And then that, I think, really intensifies the contest. So to look at this case in its historical moment, I think, was very instructive for me to kind of understand that that time in history also kind of meant that science then had to cement its position. The other important mention in the first case was that of engineering emerging as a profession. And I do have a comparative case that I want to talk about. But the fact that in the second case, there is a very clear other. There is a very clear us and them, and it's a contest of two, which in some ways is an easier contest because it's really like a battle. But in the first case, it's really about distinguishing yourself from two extremely polar sort of, you know, fields. One completely in the domain of ideology, and one on the ground. And here I'm thinking of that very famous painting. Is it by Raphael, you know, who depicts all the scientists and scholars in ancient Greece, and one is pointing to the sky and the other to the ground. And the fact that, you know, you need to engage with the ideal and the material both. And now science is kind of trying to make its way in between. The reason I think that struck me was I was recently reading about the history of Hinduism as a religion. And so from science, if we go into that domain, towards the end of this paper, Guerin does talk about how this plays out in other disciplines and fields. But I recently read that Hinduism as a religion came to be defined much later. It was a group of religious traditions which was never very clearly defined. It was very ambiguous. It was plural in philosophy. But it was only when it encountered religions from the West and newer religions emerging in India, such as Buddhism or Jainism or Sikhism, that Hinduism felt the need to then sort of distinguish itself as a body of beliefs and ideologies. And a very similar dynamic seems to have played out, where it became very sort of, you know, like narrow and cemented in the way it saw itself and how it comes to be defined today. So this idea that the emergence of something else then pushes an existing body of beliefs and knowledge to now suddenly erect walls, to come up with distinctions, you know. So an amoeba or a very ambiguous set of beliefs sort of then begins to sort of, you know, take shape and emerge into something. So I thought these two cases were very different in that sense. And the first one was slightly trickier to achieve, you know, the place of science in history.
No, thanks. Thanks for that, Anu, because I had a similar challenge when reading the first case, because, of course, whenever people talk about Christianity or any particular denomination within the Christianity, it's very easy to generalize because the level of political involvement, the relationship between the clergy and the people has changed so much over the years. You almost have to be specific about, well, what was the church in Victorian England? It was very different than other places. And so, you know, obviously for what amounts to a very straightforward 13-page commentary that Guerin put together, there's no room for that kind of nuance. And I'm sure we'll get this a little bit more into part two. The boundary between science and religion remains contested. And it remains contested in multiple dimensions, because which religions are you talking about in at any given time? Because you have, for example, some faiths have embraced science and incorporate scientific principles into the faith, whereas others reject it utterly. And they say, you know, we have established our ideology, we have our way of thinking, and we will reject anything else that challenges those foundational ideas. There's a lot of generalization that's used in this paper to great effect, but we also have to think much more nuanced if we're going to do something with these ideas, is be my point.
Yeah. Also, I mean, to some extent, when I read this, it did feel like, let's say if it was under peer review today, they would push the author towards a bit more of a theoretical model or framework, because right now it is kind of a precursor to any theoretical model or framework. Kind of here are some types of boundary work. Here's sometimes there's an other, sometimes there's ambiguity you can leverage. Sometimes you're trying to dominate from within and so on. And towards the end, he summarizes across them, but still not telling us necessarily, for example, what to expect at which stage of the life cycle. One can read between the lines and form one's own opinion. For example, perhaps the first case is, and in his words, it's about expansion of authority. And so then you've got this ability to leverage the ambiguity because you're just trying to place yourself alongside others and make room for yourself. For example, in the universities, if you're at trying to get science into Cambridge University in the Middle Ages, or even in the late Enlightenment era, you're competing with religion and other fields. In the second case, it's boundary work, not for the sake of expansion, but for the sake of monopolization. That's the word he uses as well, where it's you're trying to say to the phrenologists, no, it's just us. We are anatomists, are the scientists in this field, and you have no role to play. This is, and so then you're ejecting, you're calling it a pseudoscience, you're throwing it out. And that perhaps might only happen later in a life cycle, theoretically. Again, chronologically here, it actually is an earlier case, but theoretically, because you need some conception of a field of science and some boundary work to have happened before you can start ejecting people from your own field. And then the third case, he is a bit more explicit that does come later on, because the third case is about boundary work for the sake of protecting your autonomy. So protecting an autonomy that is now under threat. So because, let's say, science has successfully managed to get government and research and other people to fund it, now the people funding you and giving you resources, because you have demarcated yourself, are trying to claim autonomy or control over how you should go about your work. Because yes, it's good to win the jurisdictional battle and secure resources, but then the resource providers might lay claims over your work and your expertise. And so then the third case we see is of the National Academy of Sciences, a report from 1982, so around the time that this paper must have been written. The paper was published in 83, on the debate of kind of how much should the government get to say. And this was, of course, Cold War era US, so how much should the resource providers providing resource to a field have control over the jurisdiction of the field versus how much autonomy can they maintain through boundary work. So my point is, it's each case is interesting because of its difference, but there's also potentially an integrative view of how these fit in different parts of a life cycle of a particular discipline or profession. And I find that implicit link, but a missed opportunity to make it more explicit, perhaps, in the paper.
I'd like to go ahead and explore the third case a little bit more, because it's kind of interesting that at the time it was government ownership on the information, because it was government-sponsored research. There were tremendous political implications for to what extent the knowledge generated is shared versus the risk of doing that sharing. There were alternatively, you know, ideas about opening the information up, making it available. I think there was a mention of the Star Wars, Reagan's Star Wars technology, his initiative. Nowadays, the debate is perhaps as it's the same debate, same issue, but I think it's probably shifted a little bit more private sector now, where you have corporate secrecy or corporate claims on jurisdictions. And it's about protecting corporate secrets from disclosure, being able to ensure that they get their stuff out for, claim the market and be the leader. To me, it's like six of one, half dozen of the other, the same kind of phenomenon about ultimately science, the process of science, kind of like the expectation of it being an open information sharing community where there's assumed to be nobility in the sharing of knowledge, up against organizational political realities that need to protect information for competitive advantage, either to withhold it or to constrain the sharing of the information in order to maintain a competitive advantage. And in this particular case was very clear about that. I love the way that he explained that in the in dissecting the case. Government controls on open scientific communication would have deleterious side effects. Scientists would be put in the position, who do they belong to? And questions about loyalty of scientists to the nations in which they serve has been an issue. And it was the subject of one of our previous episodes when we talked about the Manhattan Project, right? These are similar phenomenon as what is going on at present, or similar debates of what's going on at present regarding, the space community, which on the one hand, you have this longstanding tradition of open, space exploration, of open work among different nations, a global community of astronauts and the International Space Station, et cetera. But you also have private interests that are entering the field and they're changing the culture, and it's changing the way in which we think about who owns these jurisdictions of knowledge and who gets to play in the marketplace. Because before it was almost exclusively the domain of governments. It's now a contested space.
And I think that actually the Manhattan Project also gives us an answer to what sometimes works, because what happened in the Manhattan Project was that secrecy emerged first among the scientists themselves. So within the profession, they were having these debates and agreeing on what to do. And of course, wartime is different. And again, a hot war is different from a cold war. But the point is that it emerged from within. And even the evidence we do see of jurisdictional battles were problems of autonomy, where, coming back to Guerin, where it's the military telling us what we can and cannot share versus us or a senior leader among us telling us what we can and cannot share, which is why that layer of professional autonomy kind of sits above the content sits above the actual practice, let's say, of secrecy. Although, again, the scientists, even towards the end of the Manhattan Project, the kind of one of the last speeches that Oppenheimer gave before leaving Los Alamos involved saying how this is not what real science is, this is what we needed to do for the moment. But the difference from Guerin's case to the Manhattan Project is that idea of autonomy and how practices can still change for a profession, but it might be smoother if the change comes from within, because at least the profession feels a sense of autonomy, versus in this National Academy of Sciences example, where they are trying to fend off the encroachment upon their autonomy from the government, from the military, from other sources.
Rohin, I wondered about your thoughts, since we're talking about the Manhattan Project, again, contrasting the third case in the paper with the Manhattan Project. I think in the third case, with this report coming out and the panel sitting, what they're trying to do is distance themselves, as Guerin says, from the consumption of the knowledge generated. Whereas the Manhattan Project was very specifically instituted with an end in mind. And again, I wonder what you think in terms of the goal and the end was kind of clear in terms of what it would achieve and possibly the damage it would cause. And so I think it was much closer in terms of the knowledge being generated and how it would be consumed. Versus here in the third case, they're trying to distance themselves from that. So I wondered about your thoughts on that before I get to other points.
Just a quick note, and we can discuss more in part two as we bring it to the real world, it's all the real world, but to the contemporary world. Very quick thought on that is there's that aspect of knowing what the goal is, what the outcome is, versus distancing yourself, saying, okay, as scientists, we are producers of knowledge, and then what happens at the consumption level is separate. But actually, the more determining factor in this, let's say this autonomy and autonomously still choosing secrecy, was less to do with jurisdictional conflict and more to do with competition and competitive rivalry. And so it was because they literally felt like they were in a race against Germany that they were happy to produce and take ownership of consumption of that knowledge. Consumption in this case is deploying the weapon, versus in the Cold War, where it was more of a dispersed thing where people are working on multiple fronts and you're just trying to be number one, but you don't feel like you're in a direct race. Today we see that in the AGI race, as an artificial general intelligence, which is also why you do see a bit more secrecy coming in, whether or not it's good for science. But again, less to do with the detach. Again, also in the AGI case, it's not about detaching from consumption. You're trying to shape the production and consumption of this thing. There, a lot of the companies are actively trying to say that we will help you replace your labor force. But it's instead of jurisdiction, it's the competition and rivalry that's driving this changed practice.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.